I saw a story about the last male rhino, and I was like, "Yo, there's still two females left. I want to do the story. I don't care who else has done it. I don't care that Nat Geo did it already. I could do it my way. I could do it different, and most importantly, I could reach a different audience." And I think that's the thing that young photographers or new photographers get scared of. It's like they're intimidated by bigger names in the industry, bigger publications, and I don't think they have to be.
Hi guys, how are you doing? Welcome back to another episode of the Analog Times podcast. And as I'm doing this introduction in English, you already know that we have another international guest this time. The second one, we have an American, I still call him a photojournalist, living in Hanoi, Vietnam. And I'd like to welcome Justin Mott here on the podcast. Hello, Justin. So
Hello.
Nice of you to be here.
Thank you for having me, and hello, Germany, or whoever else is listening.
I've been watching a lot of your YouTube content on photography lately, and as you lied to introduce yourself, you're broadcasting today live from your home in Hanoi, Vietnam. How did that happen? How did an American photojournalist end up in Hanoi?
Oh, well, the short story is I came here just to explore my photography and work on projects and met a Vietnamese woman and never left. The long version is I was studying journalism at San Francisco State, and I was about a year from graduating. I had about a year's worth of credits left, and my father had passed away, and I decided to go back to the East Coast. So I was living in San Francisco. I went back to the East Coast in Rhode Island, spent a summer on this little island where he grew up called Block Island. Quite a fascinating place, like quintessential Northeast, lighthouses, beaches, a really tiny place. But I wanted to just take a break and sort of have some closure with him. And I didn't know a lot of his, like, he has a lot of half-brothers and cousins and all these people and, like, my family heritage. I didn't know that well. And so I always wanted to work there summer. I thought it'd be a good time to do so. I needed, in America, I just wanted to have on my resume, newspaper working, having worked an internship. So I volunteered at, like, the island newspaper for the summer, which was like going from San Francisco, photographing stories about heroin addicts, needle exchange, homelessness, going to this small island town of a lot of wealthy people, photographing like, oh, they painted the beach pavilion, things like that. But I spent the summer there. I saved up some money. I was going to just take a trip to Southeast Asia. While I was there waiting, I was waiting tables at a fancy restaurant. I waited on a copy editor at a Time magazine, and they politely invited me. Oh, if you're ever in New York, and I don't think it was very genuine. They were drinking. I was their server, but I said, yeah, okay. I took them up on the offer at the end of the summer. I talked to one of the editors there. I had the worst quality photos, you know, not ready for Time magazine at all, but talked to her. She said there was a workshop in Cambodia. I took that workshop with Gary Knight. He's a famous conflict photographer, one of the founders of Seven. And it just really changed my way of looking at things. So after that workshop, I came to Vietnam. I was supposed to be here, you know, just as a backpacker with purpose, I would say. I was working on stories, trying to refine my craft. I came to Hanoi. Hanoi was the first stop that actually it took some time to slow down a bit and get to know the photography community and work on projects. And the people were so nice here. My camera was just as excited as I was. I was turning it everywhere, photographing everything. You know, I fell in love and I was inspired. And then over the next couple of years, I kept going back to San Francisco for a few months, but I kept finding myself drawn back to Vietnam. And then I just said, I don't advocate this for most people, but I had some credits left to school, but I was like, screw it. I'm just gonna see what it's like to start a career out here. So rather than take that very American approach, which was 20 years ago, I came out here about 20 years ago, which was like small newspaper, mid newspaper, bigger newspaper, then maybe, you know, whatever, full-time staff job. I didn't want to take that approach. I just wanted to work as a freelancer, try different stories, work on projects. And I just kind of said, screw it, I'm going to come out here and make it work. And I did. And I started working for the New York Times, and I didn't want to lose my place. And I never really left because of that. I was afraid to lose my spot because I knew I like to think you're really good and talented, but I knew I was the guy in the region. I knew I was good at assignment work, but I didn't, you know, I knew I could easily be replaced too. So I didn't want that to happen. So I never really looked back. And then, you know, I turned into, you said I'm a photojournalist. I started my career as one. I still work sometimes doing that kind of work, but I do a lot of personal projects, a lot of commercial photography. And so I gave you the short and the long version. Sorry.
That's amazing. People can pick either one as they like. Do you feel like your location, being located in Vietnam, has helped your career? Because like you said a few seconds ago, you were just the guy in the region, so they didn't have to send anybody if they had any stories that need to be covered. You were already there on place. Did that help your career? Do you think you would have had a different career if it wouldn't have been for this specific location?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think there's pros and cons of it. I think the pros were it was very cheap to live here, so I could afford to sort of craft my work on projects, and my rent was like, my rent in Cambodia was $50 a month. My rent in Vietnam was like $100 a month, so it was pretty cheap to get by. And as an assignment photographer, you're not making much money, you know. And even now, the rates haven't changed much. So it gave me a lot of opportunity to explore. It also threw me into the fire, though, of just saying like, okay, how do I make this a career? How do I do this? What do I do when I'm not shooting? And I just learned on my own, because we didn't learn that in school. I learned all the ethics about how to be a photojournalist. I learned work ethic. I learned journalistic ethics, moral ethics, all that kind of stuff. But I didn't know what to do. I didn't know the business side. So I just learned on my own. And I'm a worker, man. Like, I hustle. That's what I do. I hustle networking. I hustle with my when I'm not working, I'm working. You know what I mean? So, like, that's why I also have a YouTube channel. I also have a commercial photography business. And so, yes, it was. I think it was an advantage because it allowed me to do a lot of different things and figure out what I like best and what I'm good at, what I'm not good at. And it gave me time and the freedom to work on stuff that I wasn't good at because I knew I could improve on it. And I also, I never really thought of myself, and I didn't position myself as like, oh, I'm the guy in Vietnam. I wanted people to think of me as a global photographer, or at least Southeast Asia and the region. And back then, I was privileged enough to be able to travel around. And it's because I was diverse in my skills. I was collecting audio, which was a thing back then for multimedia slideshows. Then I was shooting video early on before a lot of photographers were doing that. So they were sending me to Australia, Japan, Thailand, Indonesia. And so New York Times, I got in with them and I leveraged that work to do a lot of other work. But I got to do all sorts of different things. I mean, man, you should see my career, the stuff I would do within 24 hours. I'll never forget one time photographing pangolins at this place that was $4 a night in a national park for CNN. And then 24 hours later, I was photographing a luxury resort that was $10,000 a night for a commercial photography shoot. So I think it's a pretty broad spectrum. And I love journalism. I love stories, but I genuinely just love photography. So I like the challenge of all of it. I work just as hard on a commercial shoot as I do on an assignment where I'm getting paid a few $100.
Yeah, sure. Do you still remember the first commission shoot that you did for New York Times? The first?
Yes, it's right behind me. Yeah. So I have hanging on my wall, you know, full circle there. So one of the guys I worked with that summer on the island, he was like the head waiter, really nice guy. He, you know, I was living out here. I got my first story published in the New York Times, and he framed it for me because I didn't have access to it. You know, living in Vietnam, we didn't have access to New York Times that easy. And so my first assignment was about palm oil. It was about how global warming was affecting the world's food supply. And I had to go do a story about palm oil plantations in Malaysia. And wow, I thought I'd go there and I'd show up and it would be easy. But no one wanted me in there. I just showed up to like these big corporate companies there. They're just like, no, we're not letting you in. And so I just went knocking on doors and finally got a palm oil plantation. This guy just had security at the, not doors really, I mean the gates. I went to these plantations and I got access. I was resourceful. I had a friend from school who was Malaysian who had friends back there, and she knew someone else that owned a plant. It wasn't like a negative story necessarily, just about, although palm oil is pretty devastating to the environment. But yeah, and I remember doing that story. I was part of a couple other journalists that were doing the story in different places. And my spread, I got a lot of pictures in that spread and I got the front page, and that was a big deal for me. And that's when I kind of was on the radar for them. Because I had visited the New York Times, I was invited, and I showed my work around, and they seemed to be, okay, hey, this guy's pretty good, and they liked me, they passed. The thing at the New York Times is if you met with one editor and they sent you to another one, that means they like your work. But if they just kind of said, all right, goodbye, then they didn't want to refer you to someone else. Yeah, and so they sent me around.
To call, we'll call you.
Kind of, yeah. So they sent me to a bunch of editors, but it still took months before I got the assignment. I was sitting in my crappy apartment. I remember just getting, I was in Hanoi and I got this message like, hey, Justin, I met you a long time ago, blah, blah, blah. Hey, I've got an assignment in Malaysia with like one of our big writers out of Hong Kong. I'm like, yeah, hell yeah. So I went, shot it, nervous, got the front page, and that launched my career, really. I had done like smaller assignments before that, but the New York Times, as an American and as someone interested in being a photojournalist, that was a big deal for me.
But a huge deal. But it's kind of sad that you actually do the same story now again, 20 years later, because it's still the same issue, basically.
Yeah, well, that was really, I guess it's probably worse now, but yeah. I had just so many different types of stories. I mean, last week I just did a story about Americans leaving Vietnam, leaving the U.S. to go to different countries around the world because they're afraid of their safety because of the political situation in America. So, yeah, I get to do some fun assignments and a nice mix of assignments.
Could you say roughly how much of your time as a photojournalist do you actually spend on taking pictures? Because like you said, it's very, very hard sometimes to get access. So there's so much work involved before you actually find yourself in a position to start taking the pictures that you're out looking for.
Yeah, so like for your average assignment or just in general? My average assignment, it would be like, it depends. If I'm working with a writer, they probably have done a lot of the research. If I'm working on my own personal project as like documentary work, I do a lot of research ahead of time, make sure the access is what I need, make sure it's ethical access, make sure the person I'm going to be photographing knows what to expect from me. I just find a lot could be cleared up ahead of time. So like when I'm doing my own stories about, I do a lot of stories about animal welfare and wildlife stories. So I do this long-term project. So I'll contact people. I need to stay with them or document them for several weeks sometimes, maybe at the most, or maybe like 4 or 5 days at a minimum. For just in general as a photojournalist early on in my career, it was just go and shoot. You know, it was always like travel a day there, show up, maybe get right off the plane, go right into shooting, shoot whatever it takes, like full days of the story. Because they're paying you a day rate, so I always wanted to give my money, get their money's worth, even though they don't pay you much. And then come back, file, spend a day editing your images, spend maybe a half day doing your receipts, taking photos of your receipts, adding it all up, entering it into their program or whatever. I mean, now I'm lucky because we have a commercial business. I have an office administrator that can help me with some of it. But, you know, my captions and uploading the images and toning the images for a journalist is still me, still doing it, and still takes a solid day to do it. But stories and time have gone down. You know, like you don't have as much time to do stories as you used to. Like, yeah. A 4-day assignment is probably a 1-day assignment now.
Did you ever have an assignment where you had to leave without any pictures? Did that ever happen that you just couldn't get access?
That's a good question. I've had some close calls. Like I had to go undercover to do a story about the illegal wildlife trade. So rhino horn dealers, and they were dealing tiger bones and rhino horns, basically the mafia. And so I had to film and take stills kind of undercover and pretend to be a buyer. And so I was able to get the images I need. I had to leave a little bit early, but I was able to get footage. I was able to get images. I kept my name off of all that stuff. I won't say what country it's in, but it was scary because then those images were later stolen, or not, I guess you could say stolen, but they were used without my permission in the country from a magazine who didn't ask me, and they just reported and said, oh, this foreigner went undercover and did this story for a year, which I didn't. I did it for about 5 days. They made me look like this amazing undercover journalist, the investigative journalist, when I really just did the story for a few days. But it went everywhere, all over the newspapers. We had to call every single one of them, my old assistant and myself, and just like contact them all. Hey, threaten them to take it down because the mafia finds out. It wasn't easy to find me. I mean, I guess I can just say it was a long time ago, but yeah, it was in Vietnam. So it's like, shit. Like, I'm like, oh man, like that was scary. And so took my name off of that, get it all down. But yeah, that was a pretty scary moment. But I've always been able to get a story. I mean, I've had simple stories that are just hard to shoot. Like I had a story for Audubon Society. They're like a bird watching and bird, you know, bird magazine. So this guy did this really deep story about this bird, the Edwards pheasant, and it's been extinct and no one's seen one for 40 years. in Vietnam. So, I mean, that's not an awesome shoot for me to go on. He's here for a week. He's super excited. No one's seen the bird in 40 years. How am I supposed to find it? But I, you know, there's always a way to do it. You know, there's always, you tell the story about the place that they last saw it. Maybe you get the guy who's in charge of the, you know, bird watching tours. So you have to be very creative. And I learned that early on in my career as a journalist from the New York Times, because I couldn't come back without anything. The reason they hired me was, hey, listen, you're in this country, you're in this region, we want you to know. And you learn quickly they don't know. Like, I get a lot of assignments where they're like, can you do this, this, and this in Myanmar in 2 days? I'm like, that's physically impossible. I have to fly here, get out. Like, you'd have to tell them, hey, this is what it takes to fly there. This is how long. This is what it takes to get access there. And that's what I learned quickly. That's what they expect from you. You know, that's the standard. It's give you the assignment, you figure it out, get it done. I mean, I had a lot of that. I had to go to Bangladesh one time and shoot after all the, there was a bunch of fires and a lot of the garment industry, and find a guy and photograph a guy that the police were looking for. I've never been to Bangladesh before. And so I have to go to a country I've never been to and a place that the police are looking for this guy. And so a good fixer will always save you. And that a good fixer got me access to the rhino horn. A good fixer helped me find that guy, and a good fixer in any country is invaluable. A translator, a fixer, or whatever you want to call it.
Sounds like you're basically also a private investigator.
You are a little bit, job. Yeah. And creative. You have to be creative in storytelling, and you have to have the magazine and newspaper back you on that. You know, they have to say, like, okay, I can trust this guy. Like, I did a lot, like, wire service stuff. Like, a lot of times I'd be on a New York Times assignment, and they'd be pulling stuff from the wire, so from Reuters or Associated Press, and they would say, like, yeah, we'll get that shot from them, but you go tell us a story, Justin. And I marketed myself as that kind of photographer, and then I got hired to do that work, and so it was sort of like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Does the fact that the photojournalistic industry has changed, like you mentioned it before, a shoot, an assignment that would have taken 4 or 5 days 20 years ago, now gets 1 day to be covered. Did that have an impact on you shifting from purely photojournalistic work to also commercial work?
I could see it coming, because when I first started, I remember doing, like, in one of the first few years of doing assignments, I was doing a story in Australia, and I remember the writer came from Hong Kong, and it was probably like within the year after that story that I did on palm oil. And so I remember the writer's like, hey, wow, they sent you here, huh? And I was kind of like, you know, half insulted and half like, what do you mean? It's like, surely there's someone better in Australia than you. I'm like, well, they sent you here, buddy. You know, like, you came from Hong Kong. I started to see it happening, though, very early on in my career, because what they told us in school was already ending, like going out and being a contract photographer for Time or the New York Times, or getting assignments all the time in these big stories and having an open budget. I could see it already happening. Writers who were, I was 28, 30 years old-ish when I started my career. I'm 46 now. And so the writers were probably my age and older. And one of the guys was, probably in his mid-50s at the time. He was telling me, he's like, yeah, I was surprised that they were sending me around. He was telling me about the budgets. I could see even myself, like, I'd do a one-day shoot. Ho Chi Minh City is a two-hour flight and a flight back. And they were like, oh, can you do it in 1 day? Because they pay you a day rate. You know, I'm like, oh, that's a bit rough. So I started to see it ahead of time. And I also just like to be diverse in my photography and active when I'm not shooting. So I was already starting to look at stuff and other opportunities in commercial photography. And then it kind of happened because I started doing travel stuff for the New York Times, then travel stuff for Condé Nast and other magazines. And then I started looking into, like, hotel and resort photography, lifestyle photography, and seeing, like, oh, in my opinion, it was kind of like all the pictures of the rooms and architectural stuff was decent. I felt I could do that well. But their lifestyle stuff, I felt, didn't have a story to it, didn't have the human element. I didn't think they captured people well. So I started to sort of market myself as this guy who comes from this background shooting for real magazines and shooting models, professional models, but in realistic situations and shooting it in an editorial style. So, for example, like, they're not that big in the frame, but, and they're also doing something. And I would just shoot them naturally and let them do, you know, like, hey, a parent and a kid playing with a kite on the beach, but don't set it up so perfectly, just play. And I'll shoot it like I would if I was doing a story about this and I stumbled upon you guys. And then using natural light. And then, you know, of course you're directing and things like that, but I would direct in a very natural way. And I found my clients you know, I started working for Intercontinental Hotels, and they loved that style. And then other people wanted to emulate their style, which in a sense was my style. So that was fantastic for us. And then I just added video to it. And even now, that's all changing. Even now, that work is like, it's not as potent as it used to be. Budgets are drying up. So I'm staying diverse as ever.
How do you split your time between commercial work, your own personal photojournalistic projects, and YouTube, which is another, you could say, another career path that you currently go in?
Yeah, so I got into YouTube because I like to stay active. I got into it during COVID, but I also like teaching, and I was, you know, I came at the same time I had switched into doing shooting my personal work with the Leica setup, and I used to work with Canon. I used to do a TV show, and I was the host of the show for 5 years out here on the History Channel. It was a Southeast Asia, like History Channel Asia TV show sponsored by Canon. But I was like, I was teaching during that, but I wasn't teaching, like the people that I was teaching weren't learning the stuff that I wanted to teach, or they didn't want to learn the stuff they wanted to teach. They wanted to learn how to copy, not to become themselves, I felt. And, you know, when I started teaching, I knew I liked teaching, but I didn't want, I wanted to teach my way, and YouTube allowed me to do that. And so now I split my time with, like, during downtime, my wife and I run our commercial photography business, but I have other photographers and cinematographers and directors that shoot for me. So I can kind of pick the shoots that I want to do and the ones I don't want to do. And I have a team that can shoot the way that I want them to shoot. And they've been trained by me and work with us. So we do that. I have a client that I can't mention publicly because it's an NDA client. I do a couple shoots for them a year, and it's like kind of a jackpot home run client. They're fantastic to work for. The shoots are right exactly how I want to do it, but and they give me a full buyout. So I that gives me the freedom to do more YouTube stuff, more personal project stuff. And then, you know, I spend my time working on my personal work when I can, which is my animal project, Kindred Guardians. So I look to try to expand on that, but that really, like during COVID, I was really had momentum there, and I haven't done any stories recently. I have to get back into it, but only so much time, man, with the running the business, with YouTube and with teaching and all that stuff. So I do teach online. I teach people online. I mentor people online, and that's all partly related to my YouTube channel. And I really enjoy that. And I just think it's a nice thing to gravitate into as I get older too, because it's something that like I can pick and choose and do it on my own time. And the right people find me, which is nice too. The people that want to learn this way and really into it, it's like amateurs, it's college students, retirees, all different ages, people from all over the world. And it's very rewarding for me. And I wish I got into it sooner.
I get that. I get that. Do you think that there's still a point for young photojournalists in trying to making that their 100% career with all the changes and all the budget restrictions and everything?
It's a great question. Like, I'm such an optimistic person, and when I started, people told me it was a stupid career, so I hate to say no to anybody. What I would say is just be prepared for challenges and financial challenges. It's a lot harder to rise to the top. It just keeps getting harder. It's like anything, but you know, you hear all those stories, like people that do, I guess, like, you know, in acting or music, it's like it finally pays off. But the thing in the end with journalism, when it finally pays off, it doesn't pay off financially. It just might pay off in, like, an impactful story. So that's different. So I would never say no, but I would say learn how to do what I've done, which is leverage those skills into doing commercial work or other types of work as well. And that's something I've always tried to do in my career, was look 5 years down the line. Like, I shot weddings for a long time to support myself when I was doing my journalism work, but I shot it with everything I learned on how to be a journalist. And then I started to say to myself when I was 30 doing weddings, I'm like, okay, fine, I've got the energy. But as I got closer to 40, I said, I don't want to do it. I stopped like in my late 30s because like I didn't want to be, nothing against that. Like, I just personally didn't want to be shooting weddings in my 50s and 60s. I know there's people that can do it. I just know it wasn't for me. You know, it just wasn't something I imagined doing. So I thought, oh, commercial work, I could do that with being a little bit older and slow down a bit the way I shoot, be more calculated and have a team support me and that kind of stuff. So, you know, I always try to look ahead a bit, and things are changing so quickly now with AI and with just people. I think what's changing more is just so many people that are learning photography online, equipment's more accessible, knowledge is more accessible, and that's a good thing. But the business side is something that I think a lot of people are kind of hurting other people by charging nothing or not caring about their rights for images or doing, you know, I see these projects that we've shot, these big budget commercial shoots, now people do it for free Or, I mean, and it's not bad, it's not great, but it's not bad. You know, they've got a drone, they've got a gimbal, but how is that sustainable for them long term, you know, making zero money or making $1,000? So that's always been around. It's been around in wedding photography, it's been around in commercial photography, but I think it's very, it's quite potent right now with a lot of influencer types out there, I guess, you know, and nothing against that if you do that well, but I just think knowing your rights for images, knowing your rights for, you know, how much you deserve to get paid, little things like, you know, getting paid for a travel day, getting paid for your time. And so I'm lucky to work with big businesses that understand that. And I educate my clients in that way, in a nice way. But, you know, I stick up for that. And I believe in photography rights. I mean, just the other day, I had someone use my image on Instagram. And I was politely said on this big Instagram site, I said, hey, thank, you know, getting the story out, but ask me next time and then credit me. You didn't even credit me. And then someone else wrote in, no one cares, dude. Just if you really want to help the rhinos, I'm like, I do want to help the rhinos. That's why I work hard on doing that kind of stuff. But if you credit me, then you go to my website, see the full story, and you can see everything out there about. So it's like the younger generation, I think, doesn't care so much about the accreditation or doesn't think about, not all, but doesn't think necessarily about the long-term business aspects, you know. And I like to teach that to people because I think it's important for all of us to know that stuff. And it's not easy. You know, I lose jobs because of that sometimes because people, like, they think you're crazy expensive or they think you're nuts that you want to charge for usage after 5 years. So, yeah, it's tough. It's changing. You have to adapt a little bit, but, you know, it's different times for sure. So I wouldn't say no to answer your question. I would just say it's just be prepared for a challenge and be prepared to do other types of work in photography if you can.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You just mentioned your long-term project, Kindred Guardians. Do you still remember when you have for the first time the longing, the passion to start working on that issue, on that topic?
Yeah. I mean, when I started my career, it was all about personal projects. I was young and I just thought, I was so naive. I was like, I'm just going to do my own black and white stories on whenever I want and make a living off of this. And then reality hits and you're photographing, you know, going undercover and photographing rhino horns, which was exciting and fun, but dangerous. But I'm also photographing like, oh, here's like a place that serves Vietnamese sandwiches. Get a good picture of that. So it's like, yeah, you got to do a bit of everything, dude. But I got really busy in my career and I got away from my projects and away from long form documentary. And then when I turned 50, I started to think, I mean, turned 40, shit, I'm not 40. Now I'm on.
Not yet.
40, 46. But when I turned 40, I was like, oh man, I haven't done a personal project in a long time. And that's really what launched my career. That's really how I found my style, found out who I am as a photographer, learned how to sequence images, learned how to tell a story with 20 images, 30 images, 50 images. And I hadn't had a chance to like unleash that again because I had learned so much in those 10 years on assignment. But when you shoot assignments, I always have to shoot my go-to. There's not a lot of time to learn and try new stuff because you're getting paid to shoot what's on your site. So I knew the importance of that. I preached the importance of that, but I wasn't practicing what I was preaching. So when I turned 40, I was like, all right, listen, I'm in a good place financially with our work. We have this business that does okay and good client stream. And so let me start doing some of these projects again. I knew when I did that story about animal, like I love animals. I'm such a wildlife and just animal person. I like wildlife photography in that sense, but I like stories about people and animals and their bond. And so I would call myself more of a wildlife photojournalist. And so then I just said, I'm just going to do it. Screw it. I got this M10D, this, you know, it kind of fits your audience because it's half digital, half analog. It's a digital camera without a screen. So I'm not fully filmed, man. I'm not that cool, but I, you know, I was like, I want to slow down a bit. I want to get back into this. And I saw a story about the last male rhino and I was like, yo, there's still two females left. I want to do the story. I don't care who else has done it. I don't care that Nat Geo did it already. I could do it my way. I could do it different. And most importantly, I could reach a different audience. And I think that's the thing that young photographers or new photographers get scared of. It's like they're intimidated by bigger names in the industry, bigger publications. And I don't think they have to be, you know. And I was like, oh, shit, National Geographic. I'm like, but then I was like, screw it. I can do it my own way. Whether it's better or not, I don't know. But I know I can do it different. I know I can reach different people. And I did, and it was great, and it was rewarding, and it's still a big part of who I am. I mean, I got tattoos on my hand of the rhino's tattoo on my shoulder. It's a big part of my life. And so it was kind of full circle, touching a rhino horn severed that was being sold for tens of thousands of dollars, and then 10 years later actually touching these rhinos that are alive in this situation because of what I had photographed 10 years ago, what was happening, you know, around the world of people poaching rhinos and then consuming them in countries throughout Southeast Asia. I mean, other places too, but, you know, for reasons of nothing. They don't, it's a rhino horn is keratin. It doesn't do anything for you. But that really lit the fire for me to start doing this project. And I just had it exhibited in Singapore, and that was rewarding. And, you know, I'm still in contact. I still have a documentary coming out about the story that I shot a while back. It's taken a long time to edit, but we're almost there. That should be out soon. And it's a big part of my life now. I'm glad I did it. I just wish I did it sooner.
One of the pictures that you've taken for kindergartens sort of has also become a very prominent picture that Leica still uses for advertisements.
Yeah.
If I'm correct.
It is, and it's funny. Photography is funny. That wasn't even my favorite picture from that story, but it turned out that they saw it somewhere. I forget even where, if I put it in like the LFI or if I just had it. I know it had been published a lot. It had been published in the Washington Post, Slate, a bunch of different magazines, The Guardian. It had a lot of different publications it was in. And then an ad agency reached out and said, but somehow they knew it was shot with Leica. I forget, or maybe Instagram. And they asked it to be in a campaign. It ran a couple of years in that campaign, and it helped me build a bond with Leica. And I went to their headquarters in Wetzlar a couple of times. Did I say that correctly? Wetzlar.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed it. And I like what the company does. I like, you know, I like their appreciation for photographers and the history of photography, and not just for photography that was shot with a Leica. And, you know, I've worked a lot of different camera companies, and they're the first ones that I was like, and it's not even so much them as it is their community. I find that, you know, I meet a lot of great people through Leica and through my YouTube channel, which is very Leica heavy. It's not only Leica, but I've met a lot of great people, and I have a lot of similarities on what we look for in our photography and what we're trying to do with our photography. So yeah, I formed a bond and relationship with them, and it's still going strong.
But it's interesting how this has changed, because I can remember a couple of years ago, Leica was sort of the brand for dentists and lawyers who like to shoot in their free time. Leica really had this this image of being an overpriced manufacturer for people who aren't actually photographers, who just like to wear their cameras as sort of jewelry.
Yeah, I think there's a lot. I think that comes with the fact that a lot of people that can afford a Leica are have jobs like that, you know. But I think I think it's a little bit of a mischaracterization as well, because I've met a lot of these people that are dentists and doctors and lawyers that have Leicas, and they come to Vietnam and they want to work on their craft, and they're talented photographers. They romanticize about the life of a photographer, but not the financial part. But they're not. I mean, I'm just like that in every case. But I've met a lot of wonderful people out there that are lawyers, doctors, dentists with Leicas that have a passion and talent for photography and really good people. But yeah, I mean, I think some of their cameras and all, you start getting into all their limited edition stuff, that's a whole other different world. And I'm also like, I'm not one of those people that's like, oh, if you shoot a Leica, you're this. I just like when I have a conversation with someone, I could care less what they shoot with. I want to know why they shoot. That's what I want to know when I meet someone. You know, why do you shoot? And what do you try to get out of it? If you shoot with the Leica, cool. You shoot with the Fuji, you shoot with the phone, I don't give a shit. Whatever. You know, I just like to talk to people. I have a very specific reason why I like to use Leica, because I really do care about design and ergonomics. But that's what matters to me. It doesn't matter to everyone else. I understand that. But in my commercial work, I've used Hasselblad. I use Sony in a lot of my commercial work too. So I just don't love their menu system. But some people do, and that's also okay. I don't understand why people get so angry about cameras. It's so funny to me.
Yeah, I stopped caring about that quite a couple of years ago too. You actually gave me just the most basic and maybe even most interesting question. Why do you shoot? What made you pick up a camera? Was it your interest in photography, or was it more like you like storytelling, and photography was just your way to tell stories? Or how did young Justin Maud pick up his first camera and said, yeah, I'm gonna shoot something?
Well, young Justin Maud was living in San Francisco, and I was bartending and going to school, and I have a very short attention span for school. When I'm in a university setting, I can't focus on a lecture. And I would always do terrible in these classes. I'm like, maybe I'm just not meant to be, you know, go into the world of academics, not meant to go to college. Like, I couldn't, I couldn't pay attention. I couldn't stay focused. And then I was like, I like the newspaper. I like reading stories. And I was like, well, maybe I'll be a writer and let's see what that's about. And I like to write on my own time and just, you know, do creative writing and short essays. And then I said, I'll go to school for journalism. And I went to SF State because it's a state school. I was living in California for about a year at that time so I could get residency prices there. So I become an official resident. That's the only school I could afford. I don't come from wealth. My mom was a single mother raising us by four kids on her own on a school teacher's salary. So everything I had to do myself. So I once I could afford to go to school, paying with my bartending gig, and then during journalism like classes, they're like, oh, you could take elective, and I took elective in photojournalism, and I was immediately in love. It was just like, whoa, what is this? We're not in the classroom, we're out of the classroom. And I was wandering San Francisco, and I used to like to explore with my eyes, you know, and just with my feet. And I was like, now I had a camera, now I could explore with purpose, because San Francisco has so many, like, I come from a small town in Rhode Island where everyone looks like me. San Francisco, everyone looks like everyone there. It's amazing, you know, and I'm into that. I thought it was so cool. Different food, different people, different accents, different everything. And so when I wandered the different neighborhoods, it just gave me an excuse to talk to people. And as a bartender, you're used to talking also to different people, and it just came natural to me. And I did really well in that Photo One class, and I remember my family all chipped in. They bought me this little Canon digital ELF camera. It was like the first digital camera I had. I think it was 2 megapixels, I think, which is awesome. Two, can you imagine?
It's 2 megapixels. That's so crazy.
And like an inch screen, maybe it's bigger. But I started learning so fast, and I've always been like an Apple guy, so I had a Mac, and I'd load the pictures in. And I just made it my thing, man. On a Saturday, I would work all week. I'd go to school all week and hang out with my friends sometimes. But then I just started taking a day to myself where I would wake up in the morning. I'd go out with my camera. I'd shoot. I'd meet people. And then I'd go have a beer. Then I'd go back out and shoot some more. And then at sunset, I'd finish up shooting and then go have a beer and look at the photos. And then just call it a night, like go out that night and just have a good time. And that was just – it was rewarding to me. And then I was like, oh, I can make a living off of this. And I didn't know what kind of living, but I just said, I like doing this. This is fun. I never thought about it as a career. Someone younger, I went to school a little bit later. So I was in my mid 20s then. And I just, once I started taking that class, and my professor, I was very lucky. The school's not a fantastic, it's not a fancy school or known for much, but our professor wrote the book on photojournalism that all the schools in the US use. So I got lucky and just fell into that. I had a great teacher, and it was a very competitive school, and that gave me direction and, you know, taught me the ethics and taught me the work ethic as well. And I just said, screw it, I'm just going to do it. I'm naive like that. I get an idea, I'm like, I'm just going to do it. I'm not a cocky person, but I just know that I'll throw time and work at stuff, and I know that works for me.
It's interesting. That reminds me actually a lot of my personal story, because I had the same issue. I studied psychology at university, and I just couldn't focus on those lectures, sitting in the auditorium, just listening to a professor going on and on and on about your topic. There was just no point for me in just sitting there and listening.
You're probably bored listening to me.
No, that's fine. That's absolutely fine, because that's a topic that's actually fascinating to me.
I still get to do it to this day, which is fun. I love that. You know, like I just did a story. I'll go in, I'll be a part of someone's life for the day, and then I'm out. You know, it's like I want to know and do it the best I can. But I mean, whatever story or topic I'm doing, it's short term, and I get to. It's always somewhere different, always something new, and I'm very lucky for that. You know, I mean, I worked hard to get where I'm at and to get to do this kind of stuff. But I've never worked an office job, and I'm 46 years old. I feel really good about that. I just can't. It's not for me. I don't blame people that do it. I understand the consistency. It just wasn't for me, you know. Once I started doing all these assignments and traveling around, it was just so exciting. You know, it was always something new, always something fun, and the pressure of each shoot to get it, like you said, like, have you ever come back without anything? No, because if I did, I wouldn't have a career doing this. You always had to find a way.
If someone were to take away your camera, is there any other form of storytelling that you would replace that with?
Yeah, I would love to
If you weren't allowed to take pictures anymore.
I would love to do, I've always wanted to do sketch comedy or stand-up comedy. I would love to do that and just tell stories with my mouth. Yeah, I have I have no bits that I, you know, maybe from this audit, maybe from this interview, people are like, I doubt it, dude. But like, I, you know, I have my things and I'd like to, I'd like to talk about them. Very light, very playful. I like, sketch comedy would be fun. I used to do that as like a kid. We used to make little, that's how old we were, man. We had the big, giant tapes and making videos. Couldn't even really edit it, you know? You just had to like look at it or play in a VCR. So that would be a, what I would love to do. Or I also like, I like interior design a lot too, but that's not really storytelling, I guess. I just like doing it for myself in my house. But yeah, I think I would tell stories, comedic stories through stand-up or through sketch comedy. I've always been fascinated by that.
That's a really interesting answer, because usually you go, yeah, I would be a painter or musician or write poems, whatever. But yeah, stand-up comedy is an interesting pick.
I'm not an artistic person that way. You know what I mean? Like if I tried to paint or tried to be a musician, I would be terrible at it. I know that. But I knew with photography, assignment photography, and I just knew that if I put the time in, I could get good at it, you know, and I could do it in that way. Like, I think if I just did fine art photography, I'd probably suck. But storytelling, getting to know people, being around them, being patient, spending time, growing, evaluating, and then just getting better each day, that's what I'm good at. And I've always just followed that system with everything I've done. I'm definitely not naturally good at photography ever.
What do you look at when you personally seek inspiration? What do you find yourself to be drawn to, rather also photojournalistic work or something completely different? What makes you what interests you? What is it? What fascinates you and gives you inspiration? Doesn't have to be about storytelling. Can be about I don't know, work ethics, which is a topic that I still like to address with you. Basically anything.
Yeah, like I've always been I'm very focused, so I always just looked at other photojournalists' work. But then I started to look at, like, so I was always a big fan of James Nachtwey, still am, have his books behind me. I have a collection of photo books. I love the way that he could tell a story, be graceful while doing it, and also be artistic at the same time in the most devastating situations. So I always respected his humanity. I've always wanted to do that. I know being in a different country or any scene, or any story that I'm doing, someone's letting me into their life and trusting me. So I learned a lot from watching him, and we have a mutual friend, and I've met him a couple times. I don't know him well, but I looked at a lot of other photojournalists' work. But I also would occasionally just look randomly just at other photography, fine art. I can't ramble off any names that I'm really drawn to, but I was just always looking at work, and then sometimes looking at painting, but I wouldn't say it's a huge influence, but just looking at ideas for color palettes. But I was just so focused on, like, I don't have a huge capacity for knowledge. So I'm like, I need everything to be focused on photography if I'm going to get good at this. And then the networking and the website and the business side. So I really did pull a lot from that. But, you know, in a new country, it was easy for me living in Vietnam. It's just, you know, 28 years in America, and then I move here. Everything's new. Everything inspired me. Everything was interesting to me. It was, the challenging part was to do it, but not be cliche, you know, not have every picture just be like a cliche picture of Vietnam. So I think I just was able to do that by spending more time with people. A lot of times my stories and my projects, people are like, oh, the Vietnamese like that come here and did, this was early on, it's changed a lot, but like, or even other photographers from other countries, they just showed up for an hour. You've been here all day. I'm like, yeah, because I want to see, I want to watch, I want to learn, I want to see, I want to like earn your trust. I'm still taking pictures, but I need to see situations. I need to see how the light changes, and moments are going to present themselves the more time I'm here. So, you know, that's kind of my approach. So I wouldn't say I have any like I looked at de Kooning for painting and color and this artist for this or that, a tiny bit of that, but not really. I looked at a lot of different types of photography, and I used to just always look online at pictures and then go into bookstores when they existed in America and flip through books.
I did an episode with a war photographer from Switzerland a couple of months back, and he also said that James Nachtwey was, of course, one of the big influences, but not only because of his images and his eye and his photographic style, but specifically also for his work ethic, his way of
yes,
talking to people, very humble, very, very calm, very respectful of the situation. Found that very interesting that people can have an inspiration not based on an artistic style, but based on a way of working.
Yeah, well, was it Dominic Knarr, by the way? Because he's a photojournalist based in Switzerland. No.
All right.
But I was also like a guy, so I just thought it might be. But yeah, so I didn't know if I could do that work. So he was an inspiration when I watched War Photographer, because it's not, my personality isn't kicked down the door. This photograph's mine. I have every right to it. I'm entitled. I'm not like that. I'm a very gentle, I'm a gregarious person, right? I laugh a lot and I'm silly, but I'm serious about my work, but I'm not an aggressive person. And I think that's a common misconception. Like, to be a war photographer, to tell tough stories, you have to be aggressive and bump people out of the way. And I just didn't like that in school. I a lot of kids are like that in my school. A lot of people that, like Eddie Adams, and I did that workshop in the US, that were really sort of aggressive in that way. And it just wasn't my style. And I looked at him like, wow, you can still do that and not be an asshole. So can I swear? I keep forgetting if I can swear on your podcast or not.
No, you can. On podcast, it's absolutely fine.
I just never know.
It's R-rated, but, so it's fine.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, that's my East Coast side shining through here, swearing. But yeah, so when I just saw how graceful, I was like, oh, I can do that, because that's my approach. And I can take that approach and it works, and it can work, you know what I mean? And it's genuine to me, natural to me. So I did look at him. I was drawn to that, one of the most, like, I was drawn to his photography, sure, but I really got into his work and wanted to know him as a person after I watched War Photographer, because I respected how much he cared about his subjects and the story.
Yeah, I can also remember in my first week of studying photography, we watched War Photographer in class, and I think there was no one in my class who wasn't touched or affected by what we've seen in this documentary. It's just it's so touching to see him work.
Yeah, if you can get your hands on one of his books, do so. I mean, it's quite depressing. I had some friends over the other day, and they were flipping through, and I'm like, all right, just be prepared to be really depressed. They're flipping through Inferno.
I do have one. I keep forgetting the name of this one. It's huge. Heavy book, which I got off eBay, and I paid $500 for it.
Damn.
Because it was signed by him. Because it
wow,
was signed by
cool.
him, yeah. So
yeah.
It's like, yeah, okay, I just get it.
Worth it. He's a legend.
Don't care. He is a legend. I want to come back to your Kindred Guardians project for a few minutes, because you've put so much time and energy and hard into that project. You immediately feel that when listen to you talking about it. Did you ever have the feeling that at some point the experiences that you've had with the rhinos and the whole story was becoming more important than the pictures that you produced?
Yes, but that happened early on in my career with another story I've been working on. I've built a relationship with this. Depress your listeners here, but I did a story about victims of Agent Orange when I first moved here, and I remember that was one of the stories that I was drawn to when I was in school. I remember looking at a book by Philip Jones Griffith about victims of Agent Orange, and that's the first time I opened up a book and I wept. I was like crying at the bookstore. I'm like, oh my God, that's when I realized the possibility of power of photography. I knew it wasn't easy to get, but I knew it could have an impact because of the way it affected me. And then when I came to Vietnam, I did a story. I did a couple stories about victims of Agent Orange. I thought my generation would like to see this story and that it's still happening. This was 30 years later. Now we're at 50 years later. But and so I wanted people to know that story. And I met a little girl there. Her name was Newt. And you know, I stopped documenting her. The story wasn't like didn't go mainstream, didn't change anything. But it became really personal. And you know, she wasn't. She's on the severe spectrum of autism. She can't communicate with people, so she doesn't speak. She can't hear, and she's blind. And she just was sitting under a staircase. And then, like, we were able to raise money for her to stay in this home, because they're only supposed to stay at these homes for 5 years. But her grandparents were getting old. Her parents divorced, and no one wanted her. So she can get her basic care there, have a caretaker, get food, you know, just the essentials in life. And so that relationship turned into a thing with the school I worked with here. We raised enough money through an exhibition And then, you know, I haven't picked up my camera and photographed her in 15 years, but every year we go back once or twice a year and we go see her and we take her back home for the holidays and then back to the center. And the money that we have with the director and with the place there keeps her in there and keeps that care. So it's like, it's just a great example of like, I thought the story would be one thing and it's something else. It's not published, but I just had an impact myself and with the help of a lot of other wonderful people. And then with the rhinos, it's become, yeah, I don't know what to do. I know what I do best is taking pictures, and I try to help with that and donate the images. And I became an ambassador for a place called Helping Rhinos, who works not just with that particular story about those rhinos, but other rhinos around the world. And I just try to do my best to help get the word out, help raise money when I can through photography. And yeah, it becomes more important than your pictures. But at some point as a photographer, you're like, what can I do? I'm not awesome at fundraising. I'm okay. But I know how to take pictures, so let me go do that and then give it to the people that are really doing the impactful stuff and just play my small part. And that's what I like to do with this project. It's the idea of this project is selfish because it helps me explore my photography and work on my craft. But, you know, I lose money. I pay for it all myself. I spend way too much time going there because I want, not too much time, but like I want to do it right. I want to do justice to them. And then I donate the pictures to the story, the people. It's just my own little, like, my own little private thing that I do. You know, I do the story, I donate it to them, and then they use it, and I help them tell this story. That's kind of like my little side project. And I haven't been doing it much recently, and this is a good reminder to get back out there and shoot it because I feel bad when I don't shoot it, you know?
It actually also sounds like a project that needs to be turned into a book or some sort of
yeah, maybe it's, I've always put that off about the book industry is so weird now, but I think, you know, I've just done this all myself, so maybe I just say screw it and publish it myself and do it that way, because I always find these days you want to get something done, you just do it yourself.
I know many artists who self-publish all of their work because, like you mentioned, it's very, very difficult to publish in another way as a book author, but self-publishing always a great
way. At some point I will, for sure.
If you ever do that, be sure that I'll be the first on the wait list.
You got it. Yeah. My first book will be a collection of all my assignment work from Vietnam. That's something I'm going to do in the next year or two. Okay. Something I really want to do. So, yes. Thank you. I'll definitely send you a copy.
That's amazing. Do you feel that I feel like there's really no way to do the job of a photojournalist if you don't have this personal passion, not only for pictures, but also for the stories that you're trying to tell. I feel that you sort of need that will, that capacity to sometimes just go the extra mile and go beyond what's actually asked of you as an image taker.
Yeah, it's like, you know, that's what happened to me. It was like 10 years I was like, oh my God, my goodness, I've only done, it's always someone else's story, someone else's timeline, and they pick I take the picture, sure, but they pick the final images. And like, that's the biggest piece of advice I can give to anybody for any genre of photography is find a project you're passionate about and allocate time to work on it for your own heart and passion, but also to experiment with your craft and fail. Like I really, that's why I got into photography, and 10 years went by because I was successful. It was kind of a catch-22, like success, maybe not like photography as much anymore because I was missing doing that kind of work. So, you know, if you can, not even if you can, just make it happen. You know, sorry, my connection's a little bit slow right now. Maybe I can open up the door because I have a giant metal door and it's messing the connection up. Can you hear me? Did I lose you? Is that better? Sorry, I lost you for a second. The connection was bad.
No problem, no problem. You're back. That's important.
I have a metal door in my home office, and now my dogs are going nuts. I thought the guys had left, the construction guys. I might have just made a big mistake. Hey, boys. Oh, it's like taking care of kids. I should say that. With
yeah,
parents.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
No, it's not. Kids are much more difficult. They're like, I know.
I mean, I have a son who's 2 months old now.
I didn't even know that. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you very much. I can't call him because he just doesn't react to his name yet. He's a little too young, but always looking out for him. I can never just relax and be unaware.
Sure.
Always have to look out for him.
Sure.
Like with your dogs,
It's congratulations. That's so awesome. Look out for them. It's beautiful.
Thank you very much. Yeah, that's actually why I needed to pause the podcast for a couple of months, because of course we had many different things on our minds and
sure.
Needed all our energy to keep this little thing alive.
Well, I'm glad you're back at it. Sorry you're stuck with me.
Yeah, me too. No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. Do you, while we're talking about those personal passions, personal passion, are you familiar with the work of Jakob Auersobol, Magnum photographer?
No, but I've been out of the loop for a while now, but like looking at like a lot of people's work recently. I need to get back into it, but I haven't. No.
Yeah, I thought you might know him because he also did a campaign for Leica when they released their first monochrome camera.
Okay.
Where he did the transit railway from Moscow to Beijing.
Okay.
I know the story about that. And he basically just photographs his own life for his projects. He traveled to Greenland and met a woman and stayed there. And this was like his first major publication, was just a book about his life there. So he didn't take an assignment to do so. He just photographed what he lived, basically. And it's very, very interesting personality, very interesting photographs to look at, very specific style, and also very interesting process. Just, not taking assignments, but photographing your life, the things you know, the people you're close to.
Yeah, it sounds awesome.
I
always love seeing new and different work and different perspectives on things, you know. It's always exciting to see that. And it gives you inspiration to do something like that yourself.
Absolutely. You should really check him out. It's a very, very interesting artist.
I definitely will.
Perfect. Dear Justin, I'm pretty sure that I could keep talking for a couple of hours. Because we still haven't touched subjects like work ethic in any way. But as I'm going back to dad duties in a couple of minutes. Thank you. I want to thank you very, very much for the time that you've taken to join me here on this little podcast episode, talking about you, your life, photography, and all of that. It was really, it was really great listening to you.
Oh, thank you. Well, thank you for asking me these questions. We need to catch up one of these days because I didn't get to ask you anything. And thank you to your audience for listening to my work.
It's no problem. We'll do a follow-up episode where you can ask me all sorts of questions that you like, and then we'll publish that as a special episode.
Content. Well, great to see you again, brother, and enjoy your dad duties and stay in touch.
Yeah, I will. And to all of you listeners out there, thank you very much for listening to this podcast episode. We'll hear each other again soon, probably in about 2 weeks, with another artist, with another episode. And until then, Justin and I say bye-bye and see you.
Later, brother. Take it easy.